And welcome to Reliving My Youth. My name is Noel Fogelman. My guest this week is musician Chris Bostic. He's very talented, been in some amazing bands, Spear of Destiny, Subway Sect, Dave Stewart and the Spiritual Cowboys, that's right, Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics, and of course, Joe Boxers, who had the massive song Just Got Lucky. I mean, their first album was fantastic. It should have had more hits. We talk about the reason why they only had the one hit in America. We talk about the other bands. We also talk about how he got involved in music. Very talented guy, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with him. So, Chris, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks, Noel.
Yeah. So, while researching, you and Joe Boxers, I came across a side project by Dave Stewart, which I never knew that you were involved with, Dave Stewart and this, the Spiritual Cowboys. I only really knew one song, which was Party Time, that was in the Flatliners movie.
Electric shining in your face, arms like a gorilla playing a stumbling bass. You were singing underwater when you started to drown. I never did like you much, so I didn't stick around. Matthew was the only man who lasted till the end. He was swimming in the kitchen when his mind began to bend. Executioners, he was singing in the band. Microscopes and laser beams, they all were being used. Girls were drinking Novocaine to keep themselves amused. Senators and ministers were hanging in the sky. People paying in advance to watch the scene go by. Magazines were quoting all the things that had been said, making fun of money on the fact that she was dead. Party girl, party girl, I saw you in your party world. Party girl, party girl, you were naked and alone. We'll be right back.
I discovered, because I never really heard of, you know, the band. I don't think they really did much. You know, you guys didn't really do much in the States. And I absolutely love the two albums. They're fantastic. Why didn't you guys have, like, more success, you know, in the States, do you feel?
Well, we had Jack Talking was a hit over here. The album went gold. Both albums went gold in France.
Right.
We had a lot of fans in Europe, and we spent most of the 3 years touring around Europe. So Party Town was in Flatliners. We also had one called Love Shines that was co-written with Michael Kamen that does all the film music.
Okay.
And Dave was known at the time for soundtracks because he'd had Lily Was Here with Candy Dolfer, which was massive over here. That was number one, I think.
Right, yeah.
But wait, as soon as the Eurythmics split up, Dave got onto me and said, would you like to join this new band I want to set up? And we're going to call it the Spiritual Cowboys. And it's inspired by South American gaucho cowboy types, so sort of Native Americans from South America. And they had all these beads and fancy gear, and it looks like a really good image. So we all dyed our hair black and adopted this kind of Mexican bandit look. So it was all good fun.
Is that what like intrigued you? Like, you know, the style that he wanted to portray, not the music, or was the music first and the style?
Yeah, he had a lot of backlog of music that he'd written that wasn't released with the Eurythmics because probably wasn't suitable, but was suitable for him. So he had a lot to, you know, to be getting on with. It's nice to have a style to accompany it. And the Spiritual Cowboys concept, it resonated with all of us. You know, we jumped on that pretty quick.
Right. Yeah, I'm kind of kicking myself. I discovered, you know, the band's so late, and it was only the two albums. Like, why was it just the two albums? Did Dave just say, I want to move on to the next thing?
He likes his projects, as Dave, because all the time we were doing that, he would be doing soundtracks in another studio. Then he'd be remixing the Eurythmics' greatest hits in another studio. And then he'd be making a video in another studio. And then he'd be running his record company, which was over the road, in premises over the road.
Right.
So he liked to keep really busy and do things all the time. And I think he had a lot of ideas he wanted to fulfill once the Eurythmics were over. So, you know, this was one of them.
Yeah. But, you know, it was you know, I guess a short time, but you guys, I really enjoy the music. So, you know, it's definitely something I'm gonna keep, you know, listening to, even though it's over 30 years old, you know, right now. But what was he like, how different was he compared to, like, the other lead singers you had? You know, we mentioned, you know, Dick Wayne, Joe Boxers, and obviously Paul Weller we'll get into a little bit. How different was he?
Dave is really a collaborator. He's not really a lead singer. This was a great opportunity for him to do some singing. And obviously, Dick Wayne was a full-on singer, and as was Paul Weller. And Dave's very much a collaborator, and he's collaborated with some of the biggest names in music.
Yeah.
And while we were out there, he was continuing to win Producer of the Year awards. So he's really a collaborator-producer.
Right. Now, like, yeah, you mentioned, like, obviously wasn't really a lead singer in, you know, Eurythmics with any Lennox. So was this like, he felt this was kind of his like time to like kind of shine, to be out in the spotlight, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of his projects. It was a great opportunity, actually, because he's like a musical magnet, Davis. He recording in LA in his studio there, and some huge names have dropped by. George Harrison, Tom Petty, you know, Bob Dylan, Lou Reed, they all came by to come and see what was going on. Because he's a collaborator, I suppose, he'd actually collaborated with lots of these people and still does to this day.
Right. So when those guys came in, I mean, how much did you like idolize any? I'm sure, you know, growing up, you know, the Beatles were probably, you know, one of the top.
Yeah.
Was it like, just like, oh my God, I'm in the room with some of these people?
Well, particularly with George Harrison, yeah, because he was always my favorite Beatle.
Yeah.
I grew up with those. And I remember my first songs I ever remember were him singing George Harrison songs. And so when he came in, and that was amazing. So we set up and we actually played right through the night with George Harrison, me and Dave and a couple of other members of the band. And he was coming up with new ideas and playing. He was actually playing bits of Indian music. I kid you not. He actually put some Indian music on. And he was coming up with some great ideas. It was just fun going right through the night. So that was amazing for me.
Yeah. No, yeah, you mentioned, like, you know, obviously being one of, like, idols growing up. Like, how did you get involved in music? And, like, what was kind of, like, your early, like, you know, memories of music?
I've got these older brothers, much older than me.
Right.
So I grew up with a household full of Beatles and Stones and Motown. And we had a music room. So we had a piano and one of those harmoniums that you get in a church. And you pedal on the pedals to get the wind going through the pipes. And these drawbars that you pull out and you get these extra pipes. Amazing thing. So there's a lot of music around. We had a cello as well, guitars and things. So I grew up in a musical household, and my mum sent me to piano lessons when I was six, classical piano lessons, which was a brilliant way to begin, really, because you get to know your way around the keyboard. And even though it's not the kind of music you're going to end up playing, it's really useful to know, because it's good stuff.
Right.
So it started on piano, then it went to guitar when I was 12. Yeah. I switched to guitar, fancy giving that a try. And I wanted to be a guitarist, and I auditioned in different bands and things, and we had lots of rehearsal sessions. And eventually punk came along, you know, punk rock in Bristol, and that completely changed everything, because suddenly everyone wanted to be in a band, and there were record labels and fanzines and gigs everywhere. And so I started my first band, proper band, there when I was about 17, 1977. The other guy that I formed the band with, he couldn't play bass at all. We always wanted to play guitar. So I said, I'll play bass, you play guitar. So I could play keyboards, bass and guitar, you see. So that it all began from that punk rock scene, really.
Now, like, you know, obviously punk rock, it's, I mean, is it more like an attitude than actually playing an instrument? I mean, because you have like classical training and now you're playing like, you know, punk music. So is it kind of like you really need to know to play instruments, or you just have to look the part?
Well, I suppose that there's less pressure. I mean, I think because it didn't really matter too much how well you played, that was the motivation for so many bands to get up and actually do it. They weren't intimidated.
Right.
So, yeah, it was a great way to launch something new. And so many great things came out of that punk period. You know, over here, it was Elvis Costello and The Police and Squeeze and lots of really good bands that weren't really punk bands, but they were allowed to, you know, to get out there because of punk. But punk sort of made way for them, if you like.
Right, yeah. So then I guess your first really big band was Subway Sec, right?
Yeah.
Which I guess had kind of different, like, you know, in incarnations, so to speak. I guess talk about the first version of it.
Well, the first version of Subway Sec was with Vic Goddard and his mates. They were going up to see the punk bands playing in London just before punk came along. There was something called pub rock. It came out pub rock, really. Vic and his soul boy mates were going up to see these bands, and Malcolm McLaren bumped into them and said, are you a band? And they sort of fibbed a bit and said, well, yeah, kind of. And he said, oh, well, I want you to come and play the 100 Club Punk Festival in a few weeks' time. And he put them in a rehearsal studio. And even though they'd only sort of, they hadn't been playing long, they managed to get something together. And so they weren't, you know, particularly good musicians at all, but they were in the right place at the right time. And Bernard Rhodes, the Clash manager, managed them. But for some reason, he didn't think they were that good, so he sacked them all except for Vic, you see.
Okay.
But then he wanted a proper band to work with for his studio, because he thought along the lines of Motown. He liked the idea of you have in-house songwriters, in-house band, and then you can have a whole string of different artists, you see.
Right.
So Bernard had the studio and the rehearsal space. So he recruited me and the other guys that became Subway Sec to be the house band for all his projects. And Vic was going to be the in-house songwriter. And so the first artist was Johnny Britton, who came up from Bristol. We ended up doing a few other artists, but mainly we did Vic because he had all these songs. And so we did this album called Songs for Sale that was released on London Records. We got signed up to this major label. And we toured that. We did masses of tours around the UK. But significantly, Bernard helped us set up this place called Club Left in Soho at the Whiskey A Go-Go, which was a weekly club where we could showcase all the different singers, and we were the house band there. That period, 1980 to 82, was just so busy because we were working at different sets every week for different artists. We never stopped.
Right.
And that was the busiest point ever, probably.
Yeah. Were there any memorable like lead singers that kind of came through there?
Well, we had a great one called Lady Blue, who was a kind of like Billie Holiday type of thing. But then, of course, we recruited Dig Wayne, who became the Joe Boxer singer. So Bernard went off to New York to convince him to come and join us. And so he came over, and so he became one of the singers at Club Left.
Yeah, like, so when after, I guess, you know, Subway Sec, you know, I guess moved on, right? Vic went off to do his own thing, right?
Vic, he got retired and he met the love of his life, and he didn't want to tour anymore. I think he was burnt out by it. So, but we weren't, we just got going.
Right. So then I guess it kind of helped that you guys were kind of like bringing in different singers if you're going to be the house band. So it was kind of easy for you. It was almost like a future audition for some of these guys, knowing, hey, we can get one of these guys. And they came along, and then just Joe Boxer's, you know, was born, so to speak.
That's it. Yeah, it was a really easy transition. But the most important thing about going from Subway Sec to Joe Boxer is that suddenly we all wrote everything. Before, it was Vic came kind of wrote most of it, or we did covers and things. But all of a sudden, when we were thrown together as Joe Boxers, we all got together with the writing. We were literally in the rehearsal room for a few months, and we came up with a complete set of new material. And because Dig was such an amazing frontman and singer, he was able to bring out the best of us, and we found that, you know, he could actually do some of this stuff we were coming out with that other people wouldn't have been able to do.
Yeah. Now, like with back to Subway Stack, you had like different, it was different styles. It was kind of like, a little bit of swing, the 40s kind of, fused in with rock. So was it kind of like an easy transition? Because some of Joe Boxer music is like that as well. So was it kind of like an easy transition for the two bands?
Well, with Vic, we found that he was actually such a good songwriter. He was really good at emulating Gershwin and Cole Porter and the sort of Rat Pack type singers. You know, he likes all that croony stuff, Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett. And so he had a flair for that. And we found that we could play that quite easily. We, you know, found that sort of, we called it Cool Bop and Swing. That was our, that was our title for it. And so and nobody else was doing that at the time. And we got quite a lot of attention because of it. And, it's funny, you do this and initially people are sort of pouring scorn on you. So what are you doing that for? And then the next thing you know, they're all doing it as well.
Yeah, exactly. Someone has to have the courage to be the first, to be the trailblazer just, going forward. Now, like Gangbusters, I love that album. It's, it's fantastic. Discovered you guys, and I don't want to make you feel old. I think I was 8 years old when I first heard the song, it was like you said, it's very different. What like and you wrote, you know, co-wrote some of the songs, you know, just like Got Lucky and Johnny Friendly, which is another great song. The Box, I think Frank Bruno was in the video, you know, the former heavyweight champion. Yeah. Also, we'll start there. How did you get Frank to come into the video? Because he was pretty popular when the guys shot the video, right?
No, he was, he was the heavyweight champion of the UK, and he was, he went on to fight Mike Tyson eventually, didn't he?
A couple times, yeah.
And, the whole, on the waterfront, the whole theme of the song was all about gangsters, and he thought it'd be great to have these sort of heavy looking guys in there. And we thought, well, you don't get heavier than Frank Bruno. So we got him in the video. And he liked that too. It was a nice bit of promotion for him, and you know, mutual promotion there.
Right. And yeah, that was a fun video. Did you guys enjoy making videos?
Yeah, it was all good fun. Yeah. We had fun, but just got lucky, of course, because we had a specially built go-kart for five of us. And we had a dog that sat in the front who was trained like a circus dog. And he was dressed up like we were, and he was like a mascot sitting in front of the go-kart. And we filmed it going through the disused London docks. So they had a Land Rover, and we were being pulled behind this Land Rover about 30 miles an hour or something, and they were filming us out the back of the Land Rover with a dog sitting on the front. That's praying that you wouldn't fall off and get killed or something. That's fun.
Yeah. So, like, how did you guys come up with the name Joe Boxers?
Well, because when we came together, one thing that we had in common, we didn't like that new romantic scene. That been and gone, and it was all frilly shirts and frizzy hair, and it was all a bit, you know, we didn't like that. We wanted something a lot rougher and tougher, so we thought, let's call it something to do with boxers. And then somebody said, oh, you know, loads of boxers are called Joe. There's Joe Frazier, Joe Budner, Joe Louis, and all these Joes. Let's just call it Joe Boxers.
Right. So, like, yeah, so, you know, the band, like, took off and came over to the States. I think you opened up for a couple bands and tour. So, like, what was that experience like coming over to the States?
It was brilliant. We played at the Ritz in New York first, as I recall. B-52s were on the bill. They were good. Okay. And, but I was there. What was amazing, I was looking out into the audience, and there was Andy Warhol watching us. I couldn't believe it. It's like surreal almost. And, but yeah, that's what happened. And we then went on a 5 or 6 week tour. We went around practically every state in a Greyhound bus. And the Greyhound bus had formerly belonged to the Harlem Globetrotters.
Okay.
So we slept on it. It was a fantastic experience. So we got to see all of the states. And, you know, it varied from the East Coast to the West Coast and the Midwest. But I remember when we got to Los Angeles and California, it was like Beatlemania. It was all sort of screaming girls and things. Whereas on the East Coast, it was more kind of, it's more cultured and more sort of CBGB's crowd.
Was it hard, like, you know, some, like, venues, like, kind of warming up the crowd and kind of winning them over? Because, I mean, you had the song out, I'd imagine, at that point, but, like, maybe some people didn't know anything beyond that song. So was it kind of hard to, like, win over the crowd?
Yeah, I think it had been released, and then we were touring, and gradually people started to know it as we were doing the tour, as it hit the charts. We had the same experience with the first single, Boxer Beat, back in the UK, because that got released and no one had heard it.
Boxer beat, boxer beat, and you'll be doing boxer beat, boxer beat, boxer beat.
went on a big tour with Madness, band Madness, and we went all the main cities. And at the beginning, no one knew who we were, but as we got towards the end, and the single was number three in the charts, and everyone suddenly knew who we were.
Right.
You see the transition, yeah, as you went through the tour, and it was the same, I suppose, in the States to some extent. We've just got lucky.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good pairing, you and Madness, because you know it's similar styles a little bit, but that'd be a good show to see both those bands.
There were certain bands that we were associated with just because we had the same kind of feel. Madness were one of them, and Dexy's Midnight Runners were another. Those two particularly.
Was there like, you know, because the album, like I said, you know, like Gangbusters is fantastic, but you only had like the one hit in the States. Like, I don't think Boxer Beat really did anything in the States. No. Were you kind of surprised about how just it was just the one song?
I think just that single was released in the States. So okay. over here there were six singles.
Right.
And, you know, the three of them went in, you know, top 30.
And
I think in the States, it was just got lucky that it was released.
Yeah. Now, do you feel like, because there are a lot of bands, like, who have, like, you know, European bands who have a lot of success in their country, you know, massive hits, but they come over to the States, only have one hit. And then over here, they're considered, like, one-hit wonders when, in truth, they're really not, but like, you know, because everything, you know, us Americans feel like the world revolves around us, so you only have the one song, so you one hit wonders when you're really not. You kind of like feel like, you know, and not like, you know, upset or anything like that, but like kind of like, hey, look at us, we have more than just a one hit, but unfortunately you guys don't know it.
Yeah, well I suppose so. I can't complain though. I'm pleased to have had one in the States. You know, it's such a big place to crack. You know, you hear about these bands, they go over there and they all split up when they tour the States because they can't cope with it.
Right.
But there's all these different regions in the world. It's like the Dave Stewart and the Spiritual Cowboys. It wasn't big in the UK or the US, but it was huge in France and Germany.
Yeah.
So there's all these different places.
Right. Yeah. Well, why was Just Got Lucky the only single released? Do you know why?
I don't know. They just released it, and
yeah,
I don't know.
Right, no, that's a shame, because like I said, there's so many other good songs on there. Which one, like besides that, which one like kind of stands out to you that you kind of enjoy the most on like Gangbusters? Like which song?
Oh, there's one called Hide More Hair that I like, which is quite ska-like. I like it because it's quite blue beat sounding, and the lyrics were about a peeping Tom.
alone, baby. You never notice me when I stop and stare when we're on the street, baby. Oh, you know it's true, you give me a view when you dress at night. You already rip the lights up so I can see. You know it pleases me, what you're making.
Really funny, you know, some of Jake's lyrics are good. Things he comes out with, it, you know, they're really engaging. You listen to them and think, well, yeah, and you can follow the storyline,
right?
Yeah, there's a lot of it's tongue in cheek, which I like that. It's not deadly serious,
yeah,
it's quite humorous,
yeah. Like, I mean, it's such a silly song. I love Curious George,
yeah,
it's like just, you know, it's fun. Now that you had this second album came out and you had,
is this really the first time?
But then, like, you guys kind of broke up before the third album came up. What happened?
Well, what happened with Joe Box is that we signed a pretty poor deal right from the start. We were being managed by Bernard Rose, the Clash manager, and he as soon as we signed the deal, the Clash asked him to go back and manage them again. So he went over to the US, and we didn't see him. So we had to get friends in to help us. So we were kind of limping along without proper management. And then we had the success, but then our A&R man left the record company. So we had no one at the record company looking after us.
Right.
And then sort of haggled over a better deal, which we eventually got. But by the time we got the deal, so much time had elapsed that, you know, you can't really afford to do that, you know. So we parted company with the record company, and we recorded a third album under our own steam. Our guitarist Rob put up the funding, and we recorded back three chords of an album,
right?
And we had a deal on the table with a big indie label, and I was quite happy with that because, you know, Madness, they've been successful with a whole string of indie labels, and I thought, that's fine, we don't need a major. But some of the band wanted a major, and okay. So they, I think that the all the sort of spending the time worrying about business when we should have been making music, it took its toll, and I think everyone had enough of it really by then,
right?
Was too weary.
Yeah. Now, I guess kind of Paul Weller came at the right time then.
Yeah.
For you. Now, like, how did he discover you? He was just a fan of the band?
Well, no, he'd had the Jam, obviously, album after album. He was number one and he was completely successful with the Jam, but it was like a straitjacket for him because he was writing so much stuff and he wanted to do solely music, and he had the same three-piece band and everything was going to sound like the Jam. And so he wanted to move into that sort of Motown-y Northern Soul sort of idea that we were doing the same thing, basically. So he set up the Style Council, and I was aware of them, but I knew that we were going to be on a kind of crash course to meet, basically, because we were doing the same sort of thing. And so our singles, we'd been on Top of the Pops a lot, and he would have spotted us, and Just Got Lucky particularly was very much in his vein. And he phoned me up and just said, do you want to come down and play on the album?
Right.
So I went down there, and it was great, actually. Yeah, meeting him was, I was a big fan of his. I'd had all the Jam records, and so that was a great experience.
Right. I honestly don't remember, like, the Jam. I remember at Style Council before discovering the Jam, so I really didn't, like, because I guess it was kind of a backlash, right, of the Jam fans change, you know, and then him changing styles and music. So was that kind of, were you, like, aware of that? Like, there was going to be a backlash.
There were a lot of disappointed Jam fans, and they broken up. You know, he must have been furious, but it's fully understandable why he did it.
Yeah.
And he's gone on to do so many different styles. It must have been such a so liberating for him to be able to go on and do all these different things.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's great, because you want, you know, creative people to express themselves. You don't want to be this, put out the same album, you know, over and over again, the Jam Volume 1, Volume 2. You know, look, Robert Plant does that too. You know, it pisses off all the Led Zeppelin fans, but he's just, you know, expressing his creative side. So, you know, it's good. You, like I say, you really don't want to have the same album over and over again and attract different fans. So you're opening up there's plenty of people in the world. It's different music lovers, so you're just attracting more people that way as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I discovered the Style Council first, you know, with My Ever-Changing Moods. That was, I think, the single that was out in the States. So now I imagine you came and toured with the Style Council again in the States, right?
No, I didn't go on tour with the Style Council. I just played on their debut album.
Okay. Mm. Yeah.
So yeah, of course, it's Paul Weller's number one over here at the moment with his new album.
Okay.
Yeah. So I get asked to do a lot of podcasts to do with the Style Council because he's got so many fans of Paul Weller. There's a whole army of them out there.
Yeah. Now, like I mentioned before, like the different like lead singers, what was he compared to like Dig? Like just their style and like, you know, attitude and like kind of like leadership and stuff like that.
Well, with Joe Boxes, it was very much a collaboration. You know, we would usually come up with the song ideas first, and then Dig would come along and say, "Yeah, I like that." And then he'd write some lyrics, and he'd sort of join in with what we were doing more. But with Paul Weller, he's got the whole thing worked out from the start, so he already knows exactly what he wants to do, and he's probably laid a few tracks down already. Weller gets more involved with the whole production, I think.
So, like, obviously, last year and kind of bleeding into this year was kind of like a big pause for everybody. What did you do to keep busy? Were you writing music? Were you also doing virtual concerts?
Just before the lockdown, we got together at a Subway Sect again with Vic Goddard, and we recorded an album produced by Mick Jones of The Clash.
Oh, wow.
And it's called Moments Like These. We completed it, and we're just about to release it, and then along came the lockdown, the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so we put it on hold until that's well and truly over. And so that's going to be released probably, hopefully, at the end of this year. So that's called Moments Like These by Subway Sect. And then, but also we've just put together a tour for Joe Boxers. This is the first Joe Boxers shows in 35 years. So we've got the 100 Club in London, that's sold out. And we've just put together some regionals around that. So we're going to play Brighton, Liverpool, Colchester, Bristol, maybe a couple of others. So that's all coming together at this moment.
Oh, that's awesome. Any like future plans to come over here or no?
Oh, I hope so. That'd be fantastic. Well, what I'm thinking is that this tour is, you know, the first thing we've done in 35 years. I hope that will open the door to festivals and bigger things.
Right.
So definitely the next stop would be we come to the US.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're hoping for festivals next summer. So summer 22, hopefully there's good. Right. We've had a few offers of festivals. So hopefully we'll do about 6 or 7 festivals here and see what comes after that.
Oh, that's great. Those like nostalgia, like 80s festivals, are those the ones that they do?
Well, there's a lot of different ones. There are some 80s ones, but there's also there's a couple of ska festivals. And then there's and the older bands that have been around, they seem to call them heritage bands over here. So there's a big market for heritage bands. So I think we fit into the heritage, 80s, ska, and contemporary bracket.
Right. No, that's perfect. This way, you're not limited.
Yeah.
You can play them all. Just Got Lucky. It was also, you know, featured, you know, in a couple movies, and it's kind of like has a great place, you know, in pop culture as a 40-year-old virgin. So, like, what was your favorite like placement of the song?
Well, yeah, 40-year-old virgin. Well, I like the other one, Just My Luck with Lindsay Lohan, because they've used Just Got Lucky as the opening theme to the movie, and there's another band playing it. They're emulating the Joe Box, isn't it? And it sounds great, actually. It sounds really good what they've done.
Yeah. And then I know, like, your song "She Got Sex" also was covered by Samantha Fox.
Her name
called "He Got Sex." I know every you know teenage boy loved her. So was that kind of cool to see her? You know,
definitely. That went double platinum on her album. That did really well. Yeah, it was nice to. I like it when that's the whole point of writing this song is so that other people will cover it. You know, a lot of people don't seem to get that. In the old days, you had Tin Pan Alley You know, you had the Brill Building in Motown. You have people that wrote songs to be covered by as many people as possible. Whereas, you know, it's different now. People write songs, I think they kind of get offended if somebody else does them, it seems. But yeah, it's great. The more usage, the better.
Exactly. Yeah, especially if you wrote the song too.
Yeah.
Right. So do you remember where you were the first time you heard like one of your songs on the radio?
Oh, well, over here we had somebody called John Peel And he used to play, he was great because that's probably why so many great bands took off through the UK, because there was an outlet for first bands. So bands would get together, and if their stuff was half good, John Peel would play it on national radio. And so that was always the first step, get your music played on John Peel. So I remember he played my first band's first single, and it was amazing to hear that on the radio. That was you get really elated when you hear that. And I immediately got on the phone to all my mates, did you hear that? Played it on John Peel.
Yeah, that's awesome. But I really appreciate your time today, Chris, and good luck with the album, you know, coming up with, and then good luck touring, and hopefully, you know, in the future we'll see Joe Boxer come over here.
That'd be fantastic. Yeah, so if anyone's in the UK in November 2021 this year, there's going to be a Joe Boxer's tour, so look out for that.
And a special thanks to Chris for joining me today. You can follow him on Twitter at ChrisBostock01, and you can go to JoeBoxers.net. That's their website. Very exciting. Hopefully they'll come over here in a few years to perform. That'd be awesome. And if you have a guest suggestion, hit me up on Twitter at TheFirstNoel19, or like the page Reliving My Youth on Facebook. Go to iTunes, check out all the past episodes we've had. While you're there, please rate and review the show. Don't have iTunes? Not a problem. Shows on SoundCloud, Podbean, Spotify, wherever podcasts are found. New episode comes out every week. Stay safe, everybody. We'll see you then.